Before we begin this episode, I want to give a shout out to all my patrons on Patreon who make this podcast possible, especially Mirna, Julianne, Scarlett, Jasdeep, and Juno. If you want to support this podcast, feel free to become my Patreon on patreon.com/queerchicanochisme, and let's start the show.
We'll do it live. Okay. We'll do it live! Fuck it! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live! Fucking thing sucks!
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Bitter Brown Fams. I am Ruben, but you might know me as Queer Chicano Chisme.
And I'm Cassandra. You might follow me on Chicanisma. Yep. Maybe.
You might follow me. You might not follow her.
Maybe.
Because you're sick of her shit.
I blocked you. You blocked me.
Yeah. It's been long journey on this online thing, right? And you might follow me, but I might have also blocked you. And I'm not going to apologize for that. But you can email us and you can tell us why we should unblock you.
Yes. Plus $5.
Plus $5 unblocking fee. Yes.
Yes.
And then it'll go to, paying for our drinks.
Yes. No. For causing us a headache.
TBH. Yeah. So, you know, we're just going to get right to it. Regan, today we have a very special guest. We're both really hyped to have her on our podcast. She is someone who has just worked hard for years and has finally reached, like, a huge spotlight recently thanks to her latest effort. I don't know what else to say about this woman that, like, she herself cannot articulate better than me. But she is someone whose work I have followed and have loved for years. So without further ado, I want to introduce you all to Jessica Salgado.
Hola. I'm so excited.
Yay.
Yeah, welcome, Jessica. And so for people who don't know you, mm-hmm. how would you, introduce yourself to them?
My name is Jessica Salgado. I am a Salvadoran poet. That means not Mexican. And I write poems and share them online and on stages across the country and stuff. And you might follow me, you might not. I don't really block people, but you probably blocked me because maybe you had a white boyfriend and you got mad.
Nah.
But, you know. Hi, I'm here, and now you got to deal with me.
Yeah. I like that you open with, like, I'm Jessica and I'm not Mexican. What's that about?
It's my new thing. Usually my handle is Fat Five Brown Girl, but lately it's like I'm Salvadoran and that means not Mexican. Because I had somebody ask me where I was from and I said El Salvador, and they're like, oh, where in Mexico is that? And...
Were they white or were they Mexican?
They were white.
They were white. Okay.
And, I live in Southern California where it's so easy to assume that everybody's Mexican because Mexico's right next door. And, you know, Mexican and Chicano nationalism is real. And then, you know, the hatred of Central Americans, specifically Salvadorans. So all of that. And I like to challenge the spaces I navigate by making them acknowledge my identity.
I love it. Yeah. And I think like a few months ago, there was also, I had tagged you in something that, I don't remember, it was an article. Do you remember? It said like you were Chicana. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, Jessica the Chicana. What, was that an article or a tweet?
I don't remember. It was for the clothing brand Hija de Tu Madre, who is owned by a Chicana. And so they assumed that all the models were Chicanas also. But my name is I'm very easy to find. That's what I tell people. All you got to do is put my name into a search bar and shit comes up and it's always Salvadoran poet because that's the first thing on my bio. So I think that people go out of their way to not acknowledge that I'm not Mexican.
And I think that's something that like a lot of Mexicans have had to confront, especially recently. Right? Like the fact that we like, and I say we because me and, Cassandra are both, you know, Mexican, right? But something that, especially as, like, talks of, like, TPS, right, and have come up, right? Like, we've had to confront our own privileges, right, mm-hmm. and the ways in which we take up space. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, like, my parents, I was born here in L.A., but my parents' home country is a big influence of my writing, and it's all over my work. So I feel like you folks not wanting to acknowledge that I'm Salvadoran is purposely sidestepping it in my writing. And I think that that's kind of, like, offensive, you know? Like, I talk so much about a Salvador in my poems, and the fact that you don't want to acknowledge it, that's hurtful, because that's, like, not wanting to acknowledge a whole part of my identity. So, you know, it happens, and it pisses people off, especially because I work in a lot of, you know, I go to different universities, and a lot of times it's Chican, like, Mecha is what brings me out, or, like...
Mm-hmm. They're like, how dare you? Yeah. Yeah. We thought... You would say that you were Mexican if we brought you.
Yeah, and I'm like, I appreciate you. I'm down, you know, like, we're, you know, Latinx.
You get it here.
You know, we're all here, kind of. And so, like, I'm down. But, like, just acknowledge the fact that I'm just not from Mexico. And, like, I don't have that experience. And my experience is different. And we were talking about, we just had dinner together. And so we were talking about that, how... identities are so complicated, even when you both could be from the same place and it's very different. I live in the part of LA where MacArthur Park is, which is where the Salvadoran Corridor is. So that Alvarado, that whole piece, have you ever been to MacArthur Park?
No.
Okay, so it's like maybe like 10 minutes, 5 minutes outside of downtown LA, and there's Alvarado Boulevard, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a whole strip that's called the Salvadoran Corridor.
Yeah.
And whereas, like, a lot of Salvadorans came and settled in there during the Civil War that we were having in the
80s. Yeah.
And so all of that is, like, a bunch of Salvadoran restaurants. And that's where you would go to get your masa for pupusas back in the days, or, like, for the lard for the tamales and all that. So I grew up very, with my community being very accessible to me.
Yeah.
And obviously I have, like, a million aunts and uncles and, like, a trillion cousins.
Yeah.
And we all lived in the same building. So I grew up hella Salvi.
Yeah, the cousin culture. I think I was reading something recently about how, like, white people don't have cousins. Like, not that they don't have cousins.
I read that article, yeah, too.
Like, my one cousin.
Yeah.
And he lives in fucking Wisconsin. And yeah. I'm like, what the fuck?
And I see him every 2 years.
Yeah.
That's it.
The one time I love the white man. Just one time in my life. A time frame. Don't ask me.
Can relate.
Yeah, the one time.
You can relate.
That's though. What I said. I can relate. Oh. You too, bitch.
I was in. Wow, I can relate.
It was just one time. I was going through a lot. I don't know what happened. But he would get on me about the fact that I, like, was so close to my mom. And I always felt the need to, like, I live with my mom. But my mom, if she's gone all day at work and I don't call her while she's gone, she'd be like, oh, you don't care about me? Like, you don't check in on me? Like, something could have happened to me? And I'm like, Mom, everybody goes to work and comes back every day. I can't be checking in on you, like, at all times. Or, like, you know how I travel for work? If I don't call her, if I'm gone for a trip that's longer than 2 days and I haven't called her, and she'd be like, you don't think about me. You don't miss your mother. Anyway, so this guy, Nick, would be like, I don't know why you have to talk to your mom so much. I only talk to my mom once a month.
Oh, my God.
I call her once a month, and then we talk about what we need to talk about, and then that's it.
Once a month. Damn.
It's just like, you hate your mother. Do y'all even like each other? Like, which, I mean, you don't have to like your family, but still, like, for you to say you have a good relationship with your family, but you only talk once a month, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's why they're serial killers and stuff.
Yeah, that is weird. Yeah, I read that article too, and it was more like, even when we're not blood related, we still have like an extended family, mm-hmm. like saying, you know, when you have like that tia who's not actually your tia, mm-hmm. but she's like your mom's best friend,
yeah.
and so you call her, like, just that support system.
Yeah.
I think the article was specifically talking about, it was written by a black person, so they were specifically, you know, talking about black culture and how they have extended families because they need that to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, it was... In reference to how white people, they're just out there shooting people. That's why they don't have their family to be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Because when everyone...
But they kind of do, because then when they find the family is just as, like, fucked up.
Yeah. Or the family's murdered, too.
Yeah.
And like, y'all could have... We could have tried. We could have worked this out. But now, like... I know we're being insensitive now, right? Somebody's going to be triggered.
Bitch! No, it's real, right? And it's like, I think the big point that they made is like how, yeah, like you mentioned, Cassandra was about survival, but also about the fact that like white people like can go anywhere and be accepted, mm-hmm. right? And feel like home.
You could be like, you know what? I think I'm going to go live in L.A. And then they, like, pick up, come out to L.A. All of a sudden, they're here. And they're driving Uber. And they've never been here before. And they're just chilling. I'm like, I love this city. And then, like, when I meet our person of color that came out to L.A., like, they're depressed.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure it out. They don't know where their people are at. Especially if they're, like, Afro-Latinx, like, Latinx folks.
Yeah.
They have a hard time finding their own folks out here. Because there's not a large presence,
yeah,
of that, or like a, not a lot, like a united presence of it,
yeah,
like there's on the East Coast,
yeah.
But yeah, man, white folks, gentrification, fuck them.
Yeah,
I hate them.
I hate them.
This
is how passionate I am. So my neighborhood,
I hate them.
My neighborhood has been very gentrified, and I was walking from the corner coffee shop to my house, and this white woman walks out of one building. Walks out of the building. Bad enough that she's walking out of a building on my block. I'm mad. And she walks into the next building. And I'm like, who the fuck are you to feel comfortable enough to go into multiple properties? That means you got white friends in the other building. And then you live in the other building. And that means there's a bunch of you here. And I'm just mad. I was so mad. And then I met a guy that lives in that same building. Like, my homegirl was having coffee with this one guy. And then I ended up joining their coffee date, and we ended up hanging out. And then I live in Silverlake. He goes, me too. I go, where? And then he says, my block. And I'm like, what the fuck? And he lives two doors away from me.
Oh my God, I don't gringo ese.
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
He's Puerto Rican.
Okay.
And then I was just like, I'm so relieved. I'm like, but I probably dogged the shit out of you when I saw you because I probably assumed you were a gentrifier.
Oh.
And then I'm like, well, he goes, I live in this building that was bought by a gentrifier. So.
Ralph.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cassandra's still in the battle out there. Yeah.
I just thought of that. I'm like, let's change the subject before Cassandra gets
re-traumatized.
Yeah. So, gentrification, right? Like, how? I mean, I'm not gonna spoil anything for you, but I saw that. I see that in your work, right? Mm-hmm. How does it come up for you? Do you think?
I tell people I've lived in the same neighborhood my whole life. I'm 33 years old, and all I know is coming home to the same block every day of my life. And I used to live in a neighborhood where I could get off the bus stop, walk home, and say hi to every single person I would see between the block and the door to my house. And now I don't know a single face. The houses don't look the same. Before, all the fences were low, so everybody could look into each other's properties. There were kids running in and out of apartment buildings and houses, and the doñas hanging out outside talking, and it felt like a very festive, like a barrio, you know, like a barrio,
Beauty and the Beast, right?
Yeah, like everybody was just in community with each other, and like, yeah, there was like the chismes and like the people that didn't, the señoras that didn't fuck with each other and all that, but I looked up one day and it wasn't that anymore. Everybody was gone, and all the places that I frequented as a child are now different things. There's a poem in my book called What I Know, and it's a list of things from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I'm placing different moments that happened in LA. And then it says, like, I can name every bus that takes me in and out of downtown LA. I can tell you what every store was before the gentrification.
Yeah.
And so I think the reason why I talk about gentrification a lot in my book is because, and I talk about El Salvador a lot in my book, it just shows that I romanticize things and I come from a place of nostalgia. Like, you know, our parents romanticize, you know, when they're migrants, they romanticize the old country, right? So you always hear these stories of Mexico, El Salvador, or wherever they're from that are like romanticized versions of what's actually happening. And then, so then you built this idea of this country that doesn't really exist. Because you look at it from this romantic ideal, and then I think when you live in a neighborhood that's gentrified, you start doing that to your own neighborhood. Where, like, I meet somebody and I'm like, man, you don't know what this place was before you came, and this is where this was, and this is where I learned how to do this, and this used to be the drugstore where you could come and knock on the back door and the pharmacist, you know, you could come knock on the back door and be like, my daughter has an ear infection. What can I give her? And the pharmacist would suggest a medicine. And it would save your parents a trip to the doctor that they couldn't afford. You know, and so we had those resources as a community that had been taken from us just because they couldn't afford rent. Yeah. Or it got exhausting and they would rather retire than to try to have to generate enough sales to be able to keep their space available.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just jump right into your book. So you actually started off with my... So your book is called Corazón, right? Mm-hmm. Recently published by Not a Cult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, like, absorbed this book. It's something less than 100 pages, but all... I think every page is heavy, right? And so you started off with my favorite poem from your book, What I Know. Mm-hmm. I'm also from L.A., and I'm actually... We're recording right now in L.A., in my home, in one of my hometowns. If you know Southeast L.A., you know, like... All of Southeast LA is like a squish ball of just like every town overlaps into the other. And you numbered everything, right? And mm-hmm. you just were so specific. And it reminded me of like how we store like memories in every street in LA, right? Mm-hmm. And you even talked about probably one of my favorite places in the world, Griffith Park. So I spent at least once a week I was in Griffith Park, you know, throughout my teenage years. And I really love that you brought that and then you brought specifically like the secret corners of Griffith Park, because I mean, I know this is not how you wrote it, but like growing up, like Griffith Park was like a queer hookup spot. Mm-hmm. So like there was hella secret corners, right?
Well, I went to high school up the street from Griffith Park.
Oh, shut up.
I went to John Marshall High School. Don't, if you went to John Marshall, don't look me up. We're probably not friends. I'm purposely not friends with people I went to high school with. But I went to John Marshall High School, which is like down up the street from Griffith Park. So you used to ditch and go to Griffith Park, and you'd go to the secret corners and make out or smoke weed. Or like, that's why I mentioned the old zoo, because the old zoo was abandoned.
Yeah.
You would go, and it's all full of graffiti and everything. And it was where you would go be with your fucking friends and shit. And I can't imagine being a queer, like the safety that... So if, for those that don't know what Griffith Park is, it's a national park in L.A. So imagine like this busy-ass city... And then this whole national park in the middle of the city. That's huge. You know, the Hollywood sign is on it. The observatory is on it. Multiple museums.
A whole ass zoo used to be on it.
Yeah, I mean, the LA Zoo is still
there. Oh, yeah, yeah, the LA
Zoo. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the old zoo is where the old zoo was.
Yeah.
And then they built a new one. And so, like, it's been abandoned and all the things are still there, like the cages and stuff.
Yeah. And, I went to my first concert in Griffith Park at the Greek Theater. Mm-hmm. I saw Paulina Rubio there. But yeah, so I really like that part. And you bring up that, you talk a lot about El Salvador. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it was so important to continuously bring that up? Because it takes up, you bring it up in a lot of pages, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the book opens with me telling the story of being in El Salvador with my sister and me being in that awkward teenage age where you're almost an adult. And I just had my first heartbreak. So I'm describing like my sister having these childlike experiences in El Salvador and then me just like wanting to be home to write poems, like sad poems because I'm experiencing my first heartbreak. And I think for me it's very important to talk about how I have my heart belongs to two places at the same time, and then it belongs to nowhere. And so, you know, it's complex. And like I said, you romanticize things a lot. You live from a place of nostalgia. And so I think sometimes you tend to cling to your lovers a lot more because you try to make a country out of them for yourself. And so many relationships, I've tried to, like, make a world out of that after feeling. But there's a line that says, like, none of my lovers have ever known what my country's like. Like, no, I've never dated a Salvadoran man. And, like, you know, so I'm like, no one is ever going to fully understand everything, all of me. And that's, like, a complex thing to, like, get your mind around that, like, no one's ever going to get, like, what it's like to, like, eat, like, a fucking jocote.
I don't know what the fuck that is, girl.
It's like, a small fruit. It's a small fruit, and to like eat a see the fact that like I
have to explain what you call me,
what a jocote, or like a semilla de marañón, like they don't know they don't know what that is, because those are things that I don't know how to translate to people. And so there's always that, like, I don't know how to translate my heart to these men that I keep trying to love, you know? And especially because the book is about a specific relationship that I had with a black man. And I didn't make his blackness or him the center of the book, because that's not what the book is. But it does, you know, in cross-cultural situations, like, there's a lot that I wouldn't understand about him. But those poems exist in a different space. But yeah, so, like, it's hard. You know, like to the first time I ever went to El Salvador, I was, like, 11. And nobody liked me. And then I was just like, my whole life I've been told that this place is beautiful and this house is mine and this is mine. And because, you know, your migrant parents, you don't own anything here. But they tell you, but back home we have all of this shit. Like, yeah. Back home you have two houses and you have this and you have cows and you have da-da-da whatever. And then you go and the cows scare you. Your grandma's, like, mad at you because you don't know how to wash your calzones by hand. And, like, you don't know how to cook. And you're supposed to know how to do that by the time you're 11 when you're the oldest. And so there's a lot of that underlined, unspoken part of my poetry that I try to put in little bits here and there.
Yeah. Do you know how to wash your calzones by hand and cook yet?
I don't cook. I Postmate.
Same.
I Postmate. When my mom goes, hola, Jessica va a cocinar, they know that I'm ordering some shit. And this Thanksgiving, I burned myself. I dropped boiling water on my stomach. And, like, I have a big old thing on my stomach. And so my family was just like, she can't even boil water. And I'm like, you're fucked up. It was an accident.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I can't. The first time I can't cook still. The first time I tried to cook 1 minute macaroni and cheese, I burnt it. Can you cook?
Yes.
Okay.
I am a mother.
Well, oh!
So you learned that a necessity. Like, could you cook before you became a mother?
Yeah. No, yeah. I didn't do it, and I think it was just because I would just prefer to eat out. Like, I just didn't feel like I had to.
Yeah.
Until I moved to, I was being a lesbian in Seattle, and I U-hauled it. So, you know.
Can you explain to the general public what U-hauling is? Yes,
I just learned what that is recently.
U-hauling is, like, when two lesbians, or, like, you know, not lesbians, but also, like, bi women, queer women, they just fucking, like, they meet someone, and then, like, 2 days later, they're already living together, they're already getting married, and it's just, like, some shit lesbians do. I don't get it, but I did it. I did it. And I had just met this girl, and she was in the military, and then, like, a month later, I was living in Seattle with her, and I didn't have a job. I was, like, a stay-at-home, you know? And and we were broke.
You were a trophy wife.
Kind of, but still broke. And so, yeah, that's how I was like, wow, like, no one's going to make me food for real.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, like, where it came from. And then that was a long-ass time ago. So, yeah, it was before I was a mother. And also, I think when I stopped eating meat, I had to learn how to, you know,
I just had to you gotta figure it out.
A bean burritos every day. Yeah, you gotta figure it out. So I think that helped me a lot, actually, when I stopped eating meat and learning how to, like, you know, make vegan food or vegetarian food.
Yeah.
So. It's funny that we talk about veganism, because in LA, because
the vegans hate you. Because the vegans.
Yeah. Oh, we had a conversation about it when we hung out in San Antonio.
They hate you too. They hate me.
We were in San Antonio in a vegan bar restaurant, right, Cassandra?
Yes, it was a vegan bar restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I had just made a meme where it was Selena making, like, a gross face, and it said, when he tells you he's gonna take you to eat tacos and takes you to the vegan tacos. I'm sorry, if you tell me tacos, I think meat in a tortilla. That's just what I think. And then if you take me somewhere else, I feel you should prep me for that, because I'm a carnivore. I don't really eat a lot of meat, but it was just a meme. And so folks were like, decolonize your diet. Like, the decolonize your diet people found me.
Ugh.
And they were, like, the very worst. Passionate about it. And then, like, culturally, it was culture shock for me, and I think them. Because in LA, vegan restaurants are not owned by brown people. They're white. It's a white people
thing. Yep.
And they're hella expensive, and they And they are one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, yeah, gentrification.
It's like coffee shop, like yogurt shop.
Yeah, coffee shop, cupcake shop, vegan restaurant, and
yoga places.
A yoga place and an animal, like, if it's like an animal shampoo place.
Animal
like,
shampoo
place. Or like those kind of places. Like, yeah. once you start seeing the people that care about animals more than people come in, you're fucked. Like, in my neighborhood, there's two PETA fucking offices a block from each other. And there's, like, the PETA Compassion Center. And then I'm like, do they teach you how to be compassionate towards people of color?
Because
I don't see y'all giving a fuck about anything. Anyway, so, I like, that's been my experience with vegan restaurants.
Yeah.
Like, they're gentrifiers. And so I have, like, a distaste for them and I always talk shit about them because in LA culture, that's what they are. But then going to other cities where, like, that restaurant we were in is brand owned. And then and you realize that so much of it is, like, diet that we were eating before we were colonized, you know? So, like, the frijoles and, and like, plant-based meals and stuff like that. And so, valid points. Okay, sure. But, like, I'm still allowed to fucking talk shit about...
Yeah.
I don't want to be vegan, like...
Yeah, plus white vegans, we can talk shit about them, right?
Yeah. But the brown vegans.
The decolonize your diet crowd is one of my least favorite crowds.
Decolonize anything crowd, fucking. Someone's just like, decolonize love, decolonize relationships. I'm like,
decolonize your nalgas. I remember you.
Decolonize your fucking nalgas. Like, decolonize your fucking culo. Like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You're trying to fuck white people and you're talking about decolonize love.
Nah, bitch!
Damn. I'm sorry, I went really hard in the paint. I went really hard in the paint for a second. Oh, I'm gonna reclaim. I'm gonna reclaim frijoles. Like, how? You just boil the fucking beans. Like,
you're gonna reclaim microwave tortillas.
Oh, yeah. The microwave
That's
tortillas.
That's another
scandal.
One. I think me and Jessica both got attacked for that one.
The microwave tortilla scandal. Yeah. I got called classist for the microwave tortilla scandal.
I think someone said I was invalidating their identity, and I don't know what. I'm just like, get the fuck out of here. Some people, I just...
Some girl was just like, you're setting a measuring stick for Latinidad. And I'm like, no, I'm saying if you microwave your tortillas, you're fucking gross. I'm not saying you're less whatever the fuck you are. I'm just saying... Don't just microwave your tortillas.
Like, is that, like, people are just...
This one woman was just like, my mother used to come home from work, and she had six children, and she would microwave them because she would be too tired to stand at the stove, but fuck her, right? And I was like, whoa, that's very specific.
Also, like, it sounds fake as fuck.
Why didn't you get your ass up and eat your tortillas? And also,
like a misogynist.
And then there were people that are like, people were like, we don't have like microwave, like we don't have access to stoves. What if I'm a transient person or I'm at work? I'm like, obviously, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about if you have the option. And it came because I was at a white person's house.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, my beloved, she's my dear friend. She was hosting me and she was trying to cook something that I would like. And I saw the tortillas and she had cooked on the stove. I see a stove. I think you heated them up on the stove and she had to microwave them and they were awful and I let her know that. And then I made the post and don't microwave your tortillas.
Yeah, people are whack. People were reaching on like, and the reason I had made that post on Chicanismo was because this fucker who also microwaves his tortillas. So that post was actually jabbed at him, but apparently there's so many people that do this too and they felt offended. So I'm just like, please unfollow me if you microwave your tortillas.
People get really up in their feelings about anything. Like sometimes I'll tweet something and they'll be like, this is gonna piss off people.
Yeah.
And I'm like ready. Like when I talk shit about Game of Thrones, and then I watched it and I binge watched the whole thing. Show twice.
Oh my god.
But I'd be like, fuck Game of Thrones. I don't wanna watch white people fucking colonizing plate or whatever, and then they'd be like, fuck you, nobody cares about you. I'm like, it's my Twitter, I could say what I want. Twitter is funny that way.
It is. Social media is funny, and social media is kind of how your book came to life, right? Corazon is a product of years of
sharing poems on everything. I published three zines before my book, The Luna Poems, Woes, which is an ode to Drake.
Of course, because you're in love with him.
Because I'm in love with him. And then there's Sentimental Boss Bitch, my most recent zine. And they were all poems that I had already shared online, but I compiled them into zines and sold them. And so, and it's how I established myself, how my publishers kind of saw, like, how well I would do. Like, they knew of me because we have a lot of mutual friends in the city. But it's really, like, how I get my work, how I go to universities and I do things. And also, like, you know, when you're sharing, when you're creating content for the public, you see what folks connect with. And you don't start writing for the likes. You start writing for the people that, you start having a conversation with your readers, right? And so a lot of my poetry ends up becoming a, like, sometimes if I post a sad love poem at 1 a.m. and I see hella people, like, liking it and commenting on it at 1 a.m., I'll be like, oh, shit, something's in the air. So then I'll write a love poem to my readers. And then I'll be like, you'll be okay, you know? And so it becomes a conversation. And so when I was putting Corazon together, I was thinking of all of the young women and femmes that, like, see themselves in my heartache. And I wrote with them in mind. And most of the poems had already been shared on Instagram, but folks don't care. They'll still buy the books. And they've been so supportive of me, and I'm so, so grateful for everything that's happened.
Yeah. You mentioned talking about heartbreak, right? And I think your book is called Corazon, right? Matters of the Heart. You know, obviously it's about matters of the heart. And we talked about how it's about, you know, how you love El Salvador, right? But also how you've been in love. And I think good in love and bad in love. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how I came into familiarity with your work, is about being bad in love, right? Because I've also experienced some of what you've written about like, you know, how men only want to love you in, like, certain situations, mm-hmm. or in the shadows, or, you know, mm-hmm. never publicly, right? And, like, so can you talk to that?
Yeah, so there's a poem called Fat Girl Wants Love, and it says, he only loves me when no one is watching, but that's okay. I don't watch myself all the time either. And I was writing about, like, what it is to be a fat woman and be desired by men, but them not being, quote-unquote, brave enough to, like, want to publicly claim you, because I feel that for cis hetero men, they measure their masculinity by their partners. And so if you have the most desired woman, it makes you more of a man to them, because then other men envy what you've been able to conquer, right? It's all about the conquest. Mm-hmm. And so when you have someone that defies those notions of beauty, you don't want to deal with the question that comes from, or like how that takes away from your masculinity. So there's been men that, like, are secretly attractive to me, or are, like, very intrigued by me and don't want to publicly be involved with me. And sometimes I don't realize that until we're in the thick of things, right? Because at first, you don't want to be public with a relationship. You're getting to know somebody or whatever. And then you catch feelings and you look up and you're like, shit, I still haven't met any of his friends. You know, like, every time we go eat somewhere, it's somewhere in my side of town, not his side of town. And then, like, you're somebody's, like, dirty little secret. And then you got to sit down and be like, do I like this person enough to be a secret? You know, am I lonely enough to want to stay with someone that won't love me as loud as I deserve to be loved? And I think that there's a lot of that in my book about the, like, you're not loving me how I want to be loved. I want to leave, but I can't. And I'm trying to figure it out. And yeah, so that's a lot. Because that's what I'm in a relationship. I was in a relationship that was that, where I was with someone that gave me a lot of relationship-like qualities, but wouldn't give me the relationship. And I kept wanting to leave, but I kept finding myself roped back in for the fear of thinking, where else am I going to find this? And so there's, like, a lot of that. The drama of it all.
Yeah. Oh, that was a lot.
Yeah. It is a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so love and like, there was so much also, I saw this as, like, a lot of themes connecting, and another one that connected was, like, ways that your family has taught you how to love, and how that translates into your romantic life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's, yeah, I mean, like, you know, I grew up with a dad that was present in my life and who loved me very much, but was also an alcoholic and abusive when he was drunk. That's rough, man. When you have, when you've been taught to forgive a man every morning, you know, you got a man that comes home drunk, turns your whole life upside down, breaks all the shit, calls you all the fucking names, hits you. My dad even broke a window against my face, like glass against my face once. It was an accident, but he was drunk. And then, you gotta tell them it's okay, or else they're gonna go out into the street drunk, or they start crying and you console them. Or the next morning, there's like this quiet anger, but they're your dad, so you gotta get over it. And so, like, there's a line in my poem that says, "I learned to surrender before I learned." I forgot what the specific line was, but it's in A Salvadoran Heart, which is the second book. I learned to forgive before I learned to speak. To turn palms upward to God and my lover, to let a man ruin me with his love, and to call the ruin sacred. And that's, like, what I learned from my family and from seeing my mom love my dad and, like, how forgiving of him she was. And there's a poem called Traditions in the book about, like, my lover, like, cheating on me. And, like, how when he asked me, like, "Are we good?" instead of me telling him we're not good, I said, "We're okay," because I remembered when my dad was dying, because my father passed away 8 years ago. When he was dying, he asked my mom, "We were happy, weren't we?" And my mom said, "Yes." I'm like, "You weren't." But then, like, in the poem, I say, well, like my mom did to my dad, I said, "Yes." Because sometimes it's just easier to pretend that everything's been okay. And so, like, that's very prevalent in my book. Yeah. That's sad.
And I think that there's, like, this, like, desire to always want to be happy as, like, Latinxes and always present this, mm-hmm. like, my culture is beautiful and everything is perfect.
Yeah, everything's beautiful and, like, old love is so bright and colorful and all this stuff.
And like, my parents crossed rivers and borders to bring me here. But okay, but then what happens when they're here? Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's very uncomfortable to talk about what happens when they're here after mm-hmm. they make the sacrifice. Right? And I think that you're doing the work of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I grew up hearing a lot, right? Like, oh, but your dad's such a hard worker. But your mom's such a hard worker. They work so hard to give you what you need. They work hard. I'm like, yes, they work hard. But, like, one, I didn't ask to be born. So, like, I'm here.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, you're working hard. Shit's complex or whatever the fuck. But I could still say something feels shitty. I could still say this wasn't good. I could still say that, like, I could still love my dad and love the fuck out of him and miss him and grieve him. But also say that his alcoholism fucked us up and, like, dragged us through the fucking mud. And that I don't know how to love a man without that manifesting itself in the relationship. There's a poem that, there's a poem in here where I talk about cooking for a lover, right?
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, I don't cook. So if I cook for you, I'm trying. And so I cook for it. In the poem, explaining, like, being on the phone with my sister, asking her how to make this chicken. And then I come over and be like, "Baby, taste this." And he tastes it. And he's like, "Let's watch a movie." And then he puts the movie he knows I don't fucking like.
Yeah.
And so he's sitting in the living room eating this meal that I cooked for him. And I choose to go to the kitchen. And I'm at the kitchen eating at the table. And he never thought about getting up and eating with me. And so we're eating our meals separately in the same space. And then the book, it says, "Finally, I am my mother's daughter." And that's what you look at in relationships, right? The women sacrifice everything for the men and we surrender to them and cook what you want to eat and we'll watch what you want to watch. And like, I'll take care of you and I'm here and I'm your mom and I'm your wife and I'm your fucking everything, but we get nothing in return.
Yeah, and we talked about how a lot of the times, like, you know, as women, femmes, you know, and people who, you know, who don't have this power of, like, manhood per se, right? Like, mm-hmm. we are often pushed into these roles of, like, mother mm-hmm. and caretaker that we didn't ask for. Like, mm-hmm. we asked for a lover. And instead, we got a child. So I know you have a poem there for your mother. mm-hmm. right? I think that's like the last poem.
It's the second to the last poem in the book.
Yeah, because the last one is about the body.
The last one is all of my poems. It's called Compilation.
Yeah.
And it talks about everything I write about.
Yeah. I saw you perform that live and it was really powerful.
It's every set I do, I close with that.
Yeah. But you have one very specific poem about your mother. If you had to read one for your mother to explain your book, one poem, like which poem would you choose? That it's not that.
If language wasn't a barrier, right?
Yeah.
Because my mom doesn't read or speak English.
Yeah.
Corazón Heals Herself, which is the first poem in the last chapter.
Yeah.
And it begins with like, and so you loved him for a long, long time, so long you thought you wouldn't stop. You couldn't stop, and he didn't love you back, didn't ask you to stay, kept on living without you. And that's what the book is. Like, you love this person so long, you thought you weren't going to make it out. But you're still here, and you're still alive, and you're going to be okay, and you're going to do this love thing again. And that's the whole premise of the book.
Yeah.
Like, and then in the book it goes on, like, remember the time all this fucked up shit was happening and you made it through. Like remember the time you thought you were dying and you didn't. And remember when you hated your own body and then you stopped. When your dad died. When a man sexually assaulted you and you survived that. Like, all the times you saved yourself. Like, you're gonna be good. Like, this person not loving you back isn't the end of it. And the book also explores a lot of the fact that someone not loving you in return doesn't make them a villain. And there's some poems that kind of try to talk about that. There's the poem that I talk about, like, my dad's drinking and my partner being sober and, like, how me being like, I get it, you can't be with me now because I'm not sober. And, like, I wish, like, I didn't have that history of alcoholism in my family, or you did, for us to, like, be able to work through that. But, yeah. But that book, that poem would be the one I would read to my mom. But then, like, I would have to explain what, like, all the content of it. And
yeah.
And my mom isn't a prominent part of my poetry. Like, I had to consciously include her into the poems in this book. Because, you know, I've always been okay. But she's always been the kind of woman that I don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
And I see that. I see you wrestling with that. And you didn't bring it up explicitly, but I see that specifically with the poem you brought up about the man who put on the movie that you, Ace Ventura,
mm-hmm.
that you didn't fuck with. And I see, I think we all have that realization at one point of our lives where, like, oh fuck, I'm my mom right now. Right? And I think that was the poem where you realized that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. So there's a couple of poems that aren't specifically about the relationship I was talking about. But I was with this dude, and it was a short relationship, like 5 weeks.
Oh, ew.
5 weeks, but, like, this dude moved me into his house.
What?
Like, we had been friends.
You were being a lesbian.
I U-hauled. Oh. we had been friends for a few years, and then, like, he had been pursuing me for a while, and, like, I knew he was on some fuck shit. So, like, I was like, mm. But then at the same time, I felt like we've been friends for so long. You know me as a poet already, because he was a poet. So I'm like, you see me, like, we're gonna, like, we got it, you know, and I went to his house and to hang out. I went in at 2 p.m. and I didn't leave till 4 in the morning. And we, like, you know, we had sex.
Sex.
That night. But we had been friends forever. Sex scandal. We had sex, heterosexual sex. People get mad when I talk about heterosexual sex. I mean, I get it. Like, I get it, we take up a lot of space or whatever, but, like, I can't turn on the queer button, like, you know, like,
some people don't have it.
I made a joke once. I was like, I'm impressed by my heterosexuality. And I didn't mean to, like, offend anybody else, but people got really offended. But I meant because folks are always getting upset. Like, they're like, your poetry is very, very heteronormative. I'm a heterosexual woman. I fuck men. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, too.
I wish I didn't want to fuck men. Like, yeah. I feel like...
Same.
We always talk about this. Like, we wish we weren't primarily attracted to men.
Yeah. I've had women proposition me on Instagram and be like, if only you were into women, I'd make you the happiest woman alive. I'd be like, I wish I could have my happily ever after. That I could be like, okay, let's do this. I tried. I tried the woman thing. It wasn't for me.
You just like swam really quick. I'm like, nope. Like,
it was just, it was like a really brief thing. And I was just like, but then somebody tried to tell me like, maybe it wasn't her. And I'm like, how many times do I have to not enjoy it for me to like, whatever. I went off on a tangent.
Yeah.
But, what were we talking about? Oh, this guy. So, yeah. The next day he was like, I miss you. Come back. And so then I went back, and then the next day he picked me up from work, and then he gave me keys to his apartment, and he bought me a toothbrush to have
in his
fucking sink. And then I didn't go home for like a week. I was at his apartment every day. Then I was there every day, so then I was grossed out by how gross his chicken, his kitchen was. So I scrubbed the fuck out of his kitchen, and I'm cleaning his house. But like, we don't have a title, and we're like doing all this stuff, and then... I realized he was broke and he was struggling, so I started buying groceries to put in his fridge, and we fucking had, like, a marriage, like, over fucking night, and it was because he was lonely and broke and needy, and I had a full-time job, and I was fucking, he was a man that was involved in, he, you know, a little bit in the Hollywood scene, or I saw, I thought at the time, shade. But he, like, had, like, he's an actor that had, like, one big movie 11 years ago.
Damn.
And was living the glory. Like, it still lives onto the glory. But whatever. So I thought this kind of man that would never be attracted to me was trying to have a relationship with me. And I was intoxicated by the fact that this fine-ass man, who I was having the best sex I've ever had with in my life, was that. So I couldn't see past it immediately.
You were digmatized.
I was so digmatized. So to the point where like I let him fuck up my credit. Like I was, because he was broke, and I was always giving him money to go smoke weed, to put gas in his car, for us to go out, to fund like his little projects, and I was so in it. So he shows up in my book. I have the poem The Burning, the long one about like I should have bit down.
Mm-hmm.
It's about him and like how emotionally abusive that relationship was. Like, he would criticize the way I spoke, the way I wrote, would call me lazy, would make fun of me because I didn't know how to iron men's shirts, because I didn't know how to cook.
The way you wrote, you let men read your poems?
Yeah. I mean, I post them on Instagram. Oh, yeah, but I met him in the poetry scene. He would go to the poetry lounge, which is the venue that I started doing poetry in. And he would shout me out on stage, and he was always calling me his favorite poet, and would introduce me to people he would bring. So he was like courting me for like a while, and then, but then when we got together, he knew that I was a better writer than him, and so he was always trying to take on. And that's why I go off on rants about like men and your art.
Yeah.
If a man can't support your art without making himself a part of it, run. Or if a man tells you he doesn't fuck with your the art form that you do, run, because that's disrespectful.
That means that means in the value.
Yeah, they don't have to. Like, I feel like you don't gotta go to my shows or whatever, but at least like, if you like, I was on a date and this dude goes, "Don't write me off, but I hate poetry," and I was just like, I don't go to fucking tax accountants and be like, "Don't write me off, but I hate paying taxes." Like, it's your job. Like,
yeah. You know?
And I'm like, you haven't even heard of my poems.
Yeah.
I like my poems.
I like your poems, too.
Don't fucking shit on what I do, so.
Yeah.
Men get fucking intimidated. Like, I just fucking, there's this dude. And he doesn't listen to shit, so he's not gonna listen to that. But this dude, the same dude that was like, I'm not into poetry, will be like, I don't want to end up on your Instagram. Because you know how I screenshot dating apps?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't... You never see me screenshot somebody I'm actually fucking. Like, I don't put, like, my personal... Like, if we're involved, it's between you and I, not my fucking followers, you know? But, like, men are so terrified of
women. Being exposed for their shit.
For your shit. Like, yes. Of course I'm not going to fucking expose your dick picture if I ask for it.
Yeah.
Like... You know, like, I post unsolicited shit. Like, don't be a shitty person and you're good.
Yeah.
But I think, like, dudes know they have an expiration on their niceness.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, so I get this thing where, like, if I post, like, some meme about, like, men, I will have no less than two of my, the men that have dated me, like, is this about me? Is this about me? And I'm like, well, hit dogs holler, right? Like, maybe it wasn't about you, but... let's talk about how I might be.
Like, oh, I just made the meme. We were talking about it at dinner.
Yeah.
Ruben and I. Then I made the meme. I took the thumper from Bambi with the girl bunny, like when they're like in love. And then I said, this could be us, but you keep responding, not all men, every time I say y'all ain't shit.
Mm.
And the dude fucking was just like, oh, you say all men ain't shit, but yet you really like us. And then he sent me a picture of a raccoon. And there's that. And there's my other ex who's just like, you shit on men all day, but yet you're fucking always texting me. And then I'm like,
because
I'm
what's fucking, the problem?
Yeah, I'm like, you're garbage, but I love you. So, like, I've been trying to work my way through that for, like, a minute. But, like, I can't, like, sure, I could fuck myself, but that gets boring after a while. So, I'm trying, man.
Yeah. was this bug making sense of, like, you, well, being a raccoon digging to the trash of men?
So, I wrote this book. I had, like, the, not an eat, pray, love moment, but something like that. So there's been a relationship that's dragged on for over 4 years, and I had just been in the hospital for like a leg infection, a skin infection on my right leg, and gotten out, and then I was still like, I recovered, laying out on fucking in my bed, and just over this fucking relationship, because he never checked on me when I was in the hospital. And then we had a whole argument when I was like in recovery at home, where he like accused me of promoting white supremacy, some stupid shit. And then, like, I told him to go fuck himself. And I was just like, get the fuck out of my life. And then we hadn't spoken for 2 months. So in my head, I was just like, it's over. It's over. And I'm sad. And it hurts. And trying to, like, rationalize it. And trying to not make myself the victim. And trying to not make him the villain. And just accepting that it was a relationship that was toxic and dragged out for a long time. But I was trying to make sense of all the mess of it, you know. And the story's told kind of chronologically. It's supposed to read like a love story from beginning to end. And so the first chapter was a really hard chapter to take care of, because it's called The Hunger, and it's about the hunger for love and like feeling like you don't deserve it and then wanting it. And so then I have a poem about like my depression. I have a poem about like my miscarriages. I have a poem about like about El Salvador. I have a poem about my dad. About like wanting love, but like not the work of the relationship, and just like always observing like relationships and not feeling like what it is, having shitty dates, like all of that, and like looking at like my track record out in front of me, I was just like, this is fucked. I'm so tired. Like my heart is so tired, and that's what it felt like. But also wanting to bring it back into like, I'm good. And I'm down to fall in love again. And that's what the book is like. We've all had, I mean, you hauled. And that shit didn't work out.
Yes. But but no, I think everyone can relate to like all your poems, right? Because everyone goes through heartbreak and love and being in shitty relationships. And I think that's like a big thing. Like every time, like I've been in a relationship, like 2 times, you know, you always feel like, what am I going to do without this person? And no, like, I always feel like no one's ever going to be interested in me or like, love me again. And it sounds like when I say it now, I'm like, that's overly dramatic. Because obviously, I did find someone after like said person, right? Mm-hmm. But every time I'm like going through that, I still, and then especially for me now, because it's like, now that I'm a single mother, it's like, another layer of like, why someone wouldn't want to date me, right? And so I think we always find excuses as to like, mm-hmm. why someone wouldn't want to date you and why it's not going to work out and yeah. et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we all, I feel, eventually do find someone, and that person might be shitty too, but.
Yeah. You know. And I mean, that's what the book is at the end. The return, the last chapter is called The Return, right? And it's not really like it talks about the return to yourself, but it's also like the return to willing. You know, when after the breakup and then the dust settles and you look up and then you're like, who's next? like I'm ready. Like, I'm ready to be ruined.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the book is. Just like, let's celebrate how messy and fucked up and painful love can be, but yet we always are down to try again, for the most part.
I'm going to come back to that. But you mentioned hunger, right? And I think that something that you also first of all, you talk about a lot of the things that, like you mentioned, Cassandra, is that like oftentimes after like we break up, right, we think no one's gonna love me because of this and that and all the things that are wrong with me, right, or that we see are wrong, that we see as faults, but may not be, right? And I think you do that in this book too. You see all the things that are, you list essentially like, I'm wrong because this happened to me, and like, you know, this happened to me and this made me unlovable. And I think you talk about a lot about like your relationship to food and how that's part of like what makes you unlovable, right? And can you talk about like how food, because even the cover is a mango, right? Something edible, right? And I think one of the poems that hit me the most is how you talk about having coffee with your father and how he was eating bread, and I think like you dip it into the coffee, and it's like how food was also love language, right?
Yeah, like, so I had, the book was together for the most part, and I was like, talk about the pain of my dad, right? Like the alcoholism, the abuse, his death, right? How I miss him and I love him. But I don't talk about like how sweet our love was at moments. And so I've always been told the story of my dad. He used to work at a bar when I was little. And so he would come home like at 2 in the morning and make café con leche and like pour it into a bowl sitting on the floor and bring pan dulce, like a bag of pan dulce, and like he and I would eat the bread together. And that's what the poem is. Like we would eat the pan, you know, and then my mom would be like, no, es café la niña. And then like he would laugh. And then I said, like, this is how I learned to love. Like this is the messiness I know of love, like the complexity of it. And then I flash forward to him, like, being in the hospital during his last days and watching him with his shaking hands dip the cookie into the coffee and, like, having the image of it turn, go full circle, where he would be feeding me the pan con café, and then this is where I'm helping him eat his cookies and coffee. And because of the fact that he was diabetic, having a cookie was a big deal. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's such a it's a short, sweet poem, but so complex for me because of what there isn't that. And then being a fat daughter, like, my dad would tell me, I'll stop drinking if you lose weight. And so, like there would be, like, a lot of that, you know, or the jokes of my uncles at the expense of my body and, like, all this stuff. So then hating that you love food so much. And having this, and then I used to have an eating disorder where I would binge eat. I would hide and go binge eat and stuff, and then I would feel disgusting afterwards. But if I was having a bad day, that was how I would comfort myself. I would go to a movie theater, buy a shitload of food, and just eat in the movie theater, and then go home. I would go to the Santa Monica Promenade, and which is interesting. I didn't include it in the book, but I would go to the Santa Monica Promenade and go watch any movie that was on. And, like, go to the McDonald's across from the AMC and buy, like, shitload of food. And then go into the movie theater, eat all the fucking food, leave the trash in there so there's no evidence. And then take the bus ride back home, like, for 2 hours. And then just fucking in this lonely fog that I was in before I learned to love myself. You know, that was when I think of, like, my rock bottom. It was those days, you know, when I was living in a fog. And, but it was also when my dad was at his sickest. And so, like, all of that kind of, like, collided. And I was sick, too. I had a polyp in my uterus. And I was hemorrhaging, and I didn't know it. Because everybody kept saying that I was going to have a heavy period if I was fat. So I wanted to normalize my period. I had to lose weight. Mind you, I had a fucking tumor in my uterus that wasn't caused by being fat. It was a fucking tumor. And nobody caught it because fat people get written off all the time.
Yep.
In health institutions. And so all of that to say is that, like, my relationship with food has always been a very complicated, difficult relationship, but it's also how I learn love. Like, you know, I talk about cooking for the man I love. I talk about feeding my lover a mango on the couch, you know, and like the tenderness of it. I talk about going to the grocery store and bringing a mango home and eating it while being sick with love, you know, and all that stuff. And I think for culturally, for people of color, sometimes that's the only indulgence we had, right? Like, oh shit, I came up on some fucking meat. Or like, I came up on da 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 whatever. Or like, all I got is some eggs, some flour, and some sugar. I'm gonna bake a cake. And I'm gonna, eat, you know, invite the comadre next door. And we're gonna have some cafecito and chill. And so everything becomes centered around food.
Yeah.
And we don't know, sometimes we don't know how to like share space without there being food involved. Yeah. And so, you know, so it's, my relationship with food is very complicated and very frustrating, but it's also very intimate.
Is there anything else you would like to add about the book before?
Oh, man.
Like if some, like something that you like, you want people to know, like if you're going to read this, please.
Yeah. If you're going to read the book, I just want you to know that, it was an act of love. It was a work of love. I poured myself into this project. And, you know, like, if whatever moves you, moves you. There's no wrong way to read the book. There's no wrong way to feel about any of the poems. You know, and you're always welcome to, like, tweet me if something. If you want to have a conversation about something. I don't know. Not if you want to fight, because I'll fight. I like to fight on Twitter, so... But no, like, it's a celebration of love, and just like, I hope that these poems saved me through so much darkness. I hope that they do the same for whoever finds them and reads them. Yeah.
Aw. All right. So that's beautiful. And so you did mention that you like to fight on Twitter. So with that fighting spirit, we're going to begin a little game called I Know Her. Or, I don't know her. And this game was inspired by the one and only Mariah Carey, who, when she was famously asked if she knew Jennifer Lopez, or what she thought about Jennifer Lopez, she said,
I don't know her.
I don't know her. And so that can mean a lot of things. It can mean you literally don't know her. It can mean you don't fuck with this bitch. Or, how dare you ask me about this bitch.
I love it. I'm ready.
All right. So now me and Cassandra will bring up random people, and you can tell us... You can say, I know her, I don't know her, and you can tell us why, or you can just let it be.
Okay.
Okay. Did you want to begin?
Sure. So, Juno Diaz.
I know her.
You know her? Okay.
Most days.
What happened?
Most.
No, I mean, you know, like...
What happened the other days?
No, I'm a big fan of Juno Diaz's work. There's been times where, like, I think his work, you gotta take it into context, but like he writes a lot in women's narratives sometimes, and I feel like you could try to write for women, not for women, but you could write about women without taking on, like, I don't know, there's a way to do that without like putting words in women's mouth, and I think that there's been times that Juno hasn't been very mindful of that, but in the largest spiel of things, like, I appreciate his work, and yeah, so I know him.
That's real. Mm-hmm. Whataburger.
Don't know her. It tastes like Burger King.
Good to know.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. Jessica's lying. And let me tell you all, because me and Jessica met in San Antonio last year, and we were like, it was like 2-3 in the morning, I don't know, we were like, let's go get food. We ended up at Whataburger because it's open 24 hours, whatever, and she had never been there. You haven't even tasted it. You haven't even been in Texas, and you're not welcome here. Anyway, so then we ate Whataburger, whatever, and then the next day we had brunch, and then Jessica was like talking shit about Whataburger the very next morning. And so we were at this brunch, and we were just like, you know, me and Jessica were going at it. So then me and Jessica just have this ongoing, you know, feud like everyone else on the internet of like In-N-Out versus Whataburger. And yeah, so that's like my and Jessica's thing. But you know what? Like last month I had In-N-Out. I went to Phoenix. Was it Phoenix? Yeah, I was in Phoenix and I went to In-N-Out for the first time. Yeah. I don't even know how you can fuck up fries. That's
look,
my thing. Like, how?
It's because you're getting it from these whack-ass places. Come to California. They fish it
how
right from the
Pacific
Coast.
How is that whack-ass place if they're the same? Okay, it's the same establishment.
I will tell you, their fries aren't like the In-N-Out fries.
I love their fries.
Are like,
you're lying.
I'm there for the burgers. I'm there for the burgers. But you're vegan, so I don't know.
Yeah, what the fuck
are you talking about? No, I am not vegan. I just, I don't eat meat. I recently I tried eating meat again, which hasn't been working out, but like occasionally. So I did eat it. And it wasn't because I was like, I hate meat. It was like just because it wasn't like awful. Like I wasn't like, you know, like I ate it. It wasn't awful. I just don't understand. I don't understand like the obsession with it because it's not that great. But I don't know if you all, and I don't know if this was like a Texas thing or I don't know if there's this chain, if it was a chain restaurant. It was called
Sonic?
Sonic Streak? No.
It's just Sonic.
Silver Streak. Silver Streak. Mm-hmm. Well, Silver Streak, that's what In-N-Out tastes like. But anyway, it's trash. You fucked up the fries and you only have like three fucking options.
Whataburger tastes like Burger King.
That's what really matters in this conversation.
It doesn't, though. But, I mean, all right, let's keep it moving. Okay, so the Nation of Aslan.
Don't know her.
Real.
She don't know me either.
True. No, but you are Mexican.
Sometimes.
Oh.
Okay. I'm a Chicana poet.
Yeah, so she just told me that she identified as Chicana when she was younger for 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, because I took a Chicano history class. And so for 5 minutes, I was a Chicana. And, yeah.
Sandra Cisneros.
Know her. Love her. Queen.
I was going to ask if you knew Drake, but I feel like everyone knows that. You more than know Drake.
Yes. I know Drake. I know his dad. Like, I know I met his dad.
How was that?
I told him I want to marry his son. And he's just like, yeah.
Well, you met his dad?
Yeah, he walked into my store when I used to work at CVS. We have a picture together. We met exactly 2 years ago.
Okay. Who was I going to bring up? You brought up the Nation of Aslan.
The Nation of Aslan doesn't even know me.
Dating white man. Do you know her? Do you not know her?
Not know her. Never met her. Don't know what that's like.
Wow.
Would you like to know what that's like one day?
White penises look like boiled hot dogs.
Wow!
You know what? One time, this was like years ago too. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. I did a lot of just, you know, ridiculous things when I was in my early 20s. I was like lonely and I was making out with this white guy. And he, like, I just midway, I was like, what am I doing? You know, in my head. And I faked an asthma attack and I left. I did. I can't breathe. Like, get off of me. And then he was like, are you okay? And I was like, I gotta go. And I just, like, left. And, like, I just... White guys are so awkward. But also, one time, I did hook up with this white girl.
Who looked like Tegan and Sarah?
She did not. That was another girl. That was another girl. But no, like, there was this one white girl, and we met, like, through a mutual friend, but, like, it was when I was in Seattle, and I was trying to get out of that relationship.
Oh, my God, you were a cheater.
No, we had already broken up, but we were still living together. Shut up, Ruben. Anyway, so I met her, like, over the phone, and then, like, online, and then she lived in California. She lived in L.A., somewhere out there, I don't know, and I lived here, obviously, in El Paso, and she just, like, drove... Like, out of, like, one night, she was like, I'm on my way. And I was like, what? And I was, like, excited. I was like, okay. Like, you know, like she, you know, we've been talking. She's cute. I like her. But then when she showed up, I was like, why? Like, you know, I don't know. Like, when you have connection with someone, like, over the phone or, like, online and then, like, in person, it's just not there. That's, like, what happened. And I felt bad because she literally drove, like, 12 hours overnight. Shit. But I was like, get the fuck out of here. But you know what? I did hook up with her. And it was the worst. It was just awkward. White girls are just awkward. And, like, after that, I was just, like, giving her the cold shoulder. And so I was, like, in my head, like, please go home. And then she did. And then we stopped talking. So she hated me. But no one told her to fucking come over here.
That's a lot.
I feel like karma's gonna get me one day. And I'm gonna, like, fall in love with, like, a white guy, you know.
I've thought of that, too. I was like, what if one day I end up with a fucking white guy? Like, that would be the worst. But I also feel it's just weird because I there's some white guys that I find like attractive, like, but Thor. They're like celebrities. Yeah, they're like people that I would never know in real life.
Okay, full disclaimer. You know how I'm all about Drake and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Before Drake, it was Ryan Gosling.
Really?
No.
I would do like the fake, really, like the
what you
doing? He's my boyfriend posts and stuff like that. And my man, yeah, it was Ryan Gosling.
Hmm.
I was in love with that man.
I don't think he's attractive. Him or what's the other guy's name? Ryan Reynolds. They both look alike.
I don't think any of the Ryans or the Chris's are attractive. I think people are just hyping up like basic white man with muscles. Mm-hmm.
I liked his goofiness.
See, I like the goofiness. I like goofiness from goofy guys, not from hunks. I really like Michael Cera, Ezra Miller.
Me
like,
too. Those are so my awkward.
Yeah. So Ezra Miller right now is my like my white man.
Who?
Like Ezra Miller. He's like the Flash on the Justice League, and who else? I only know him from indie films, TBH. I think his biggest indie film was Perks of a Wallflower. He plays the queer character. Anyway, so that's
I was a big Ryan Gosling.
But it's like there was this one poem, Yesika, and it's not from your book. I had shared it on Chicanismo maybe last year, and it was like about how you only date you don't date white men, you only date. It was like, I don't know what the wording was, but it was like, I can only date the reflection of me.
Yeah.
Do you remember? And I shared it, and I really
it's connected called to white that. Men. It's called White Men on OkCupid, and it's on Huffington Post.
Yes, yeah. That's the
one. Oh my God, you got hella hate for that. I remember this.
Mm-hmm. It was a mess. My comment section was a mess because I shared that. But I really connected to that. And also because, like, when I think about dating or, like, in the future, if I get married one day, like, I just don't see myself with a white man. And I think it's also because it would just be fucking exhausting because, like, you're already dealing with, like, emotional labor on, like, sexism, misogyny from a man. And then, like, adding to that, like, explaining what fucking racism is and then microaggressions from their racist family. Like, I don't fucking think so. Like, no. Yeah, it just sounds like
it says
too fucking much.
It says, I can't date someone that, I don't know, something about someone that doesn't know, like, what my experience is like. I can't date somebody that doesn't look like my own reflection. And it's, like, it's true. Like, I can't date someone that's not a man of color. I don't want to have to, like, I was about to say some shit, but I'm going to just be quiet. I've witnessed relationships like that and, like, see how fucking awkwardly people navigated and shit. I'm like, I don't want to have to worry about that, you know? Like, it's already complicated, like, within people of color that we're from different countries or whatever. You can only imagine, like, having to deal with the fact that our cultures aren't the same and your culture oppresses mine.
Yeah. I mean...
Or, like, you appropriate fucking cultures. And then I'm going to have to be checking you that you don't fucking appropriate my culture.
Yeah.
Because you're probably going to feel that it's a part of you. Like, yeah, like, I don't want to have a white dude that thinks he's, like, half Salvadoran now just because he has a half Salvadoran child.
Yeah. I can talk about... Yeah, this, like, I mean, I was in a long-term relationship with a white man, and, like, we were, like, really serious, like, we were going to get married, but he was respectful of not crossing those type of borders, but he was also, like, not someone that checked his own, like, microaggressions or his friends' microaggressions or his family microaggressions, and that got exhausting. So, like, for me, it's, like, also, like, I don't know her, like, at this point in my life, like, I don't know dating women.
No, I don't know them.
All right, so... So, yeah, so that was I Know Her or I Don't Know Her, right? Thank you for playing. And so now we are going to talk about the last thing. We always end our episodes with a song, right? And I was talking to you earlier how, like, you know, there's certain music that plays for me when I read. And I always set mood music for myself when I read. Mm-hmm. What was playing when you wrote this? What plays now when you read this? What do you hope people listen to when they engage this? What is even something that is inspiring you now? Or, like, what's a song that you just want to play for the fuck of it?
I listen to a lot of Juan Gabriel. He Venido a Pedirte is a song by Juan Gabriel that, like, I listen to on repeat a lot. I don't remember what else I was listening to. I don't really play music. I'll listen to a song and it'll make me feel a feeling, but when I'm actually writing, I'm not listening to music because I don't want to, like, use their wording, like, subconsciously absorb their wording and use it in my writing. Because sometimes you do that, you don't realize it when you're using somebody else's words. But there's a... So I have a Spotify, and if you search Yesika Salgado, you find it. And there's a playlist right now that I have there. It's called Mommy's Playlist. And I sat down with my mom one Saturday. She was going through stuff and she was cleaning out stuff in the house. And I was just asking her what her favorite love songs are in Spanish. And it's a whole playlist of sad Spanish love songs. There's Los Bukis, Los Temerarios, Los Caminantes, Juan Gabriel. There might be like a little bit of Chente in there. Rocío Durcal, Amanda Gabriel. Like all of these like Spanish love songs that I grew up listening to. And yeah, oh my God. Okay, my big one song right now is Yo Te Necesito by Los Bukis. Do you know, are you familiar with that song?
Maybe if we play it, I can remember.
Yeah, so it's called Yo Te Necesito by the, yeah. But if you watch the video, I ask you to please watch the video. If you ever have a chance, it's called Yo Te Necesito by Los Bukis. And the tambourine player in the video gives me all the fucking life. And he's like in the background losing his shit the whole time he's playing it. But the song is like a really sad song, and it's kind of like the, like, I tell people I learned to write poetry through love songs. Mm-hmm. Like, it's where I learned to write about longing and desire and all of that stuff by listening to all of these Spanish love songs. And Juan Gabriel and Los Bukis were very, very, very big parts of that because they were my parents' favorite, like, people to listen to. And it's like, just listening to them causes like an eight, like, that tightening in your chest that you don't know how to describe what that nostalgic feeling is. Yeah, so go listen to that playlist. That's pretty much anything on there is probably like the feelings I try to emote when I write.
All right, Jessica Salgado is your Spotify name.
And Mommy's Playlist.
Mommy's Playlist. What one song should we play for people today?
You know what? You know what song is really, like, I don't want to do a sad song, but Redbone by Childish Gambino.
Okay.
That song, I listened to it on repeat too while I was writing this book. That definitely I listened to it on repeat. It just makes you feel grown and sexy.
Okay.
All right.
That is Baby Mickey music. Right.
Redbone. So you could go find a new boo and like, yeah.
All right. So we're about to play Redbone by Childish Gambino. Before we go, where can people find you?
Instagram at Jessica Starr. So YESIKASTARR. And you can find me on Twitter by that too. Or jessicasalgado.com, YESIKASALGADO.com.
All right. So book her, read her work, buy her book. Or if you share this episode on Twitter, on Instagram and Facebook and tag Bitter Brown Femmes on Instagram, Bitter B Femmes on Twitter, and Queer Chicano Chisme on Facebook. We'll pick one lucky winner to get a signed copy of Jessica Salgado's Corazón, and that'll be in your mailbox sooner than you know it.
Thank you so much for having me. I love you both so much.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I feel like I wish I was there right now in LA.
We'll be together soon.
Yeah. One day again. We will not go to In-N-Out. We will not go to Whataburger.
Just come to California and eat California In-N-Out. Whatever.
I'll take you to eat like pupusas.
Yeah. Yes, that sounds better.
Mm-hmm. All right. So again, thank you for coming in, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
And thank y'all for tuning in to another episode of Bitter Brown Femmes. We hope you liked it. We hope you join us. We hope you tell your mom about this. We hope you tell your cousin, your vecina that you hate. Just tell her to hate listen to us. All right? All right. And with that, it's going to be a bye from us. All right. Bye, everyone.